Hi, I'm Fabi Fav.
And this is Babelito.
And we are
Latinos Who Lunch,
the podcast where we talk about important things like
de tu arte a mi arte, prefiero mi arte.
Hello, hello, hello.
Que show.
How are you?
I'm fucking cold. How are you?
I'm cold too. Because what?
Because it's snowing and we're in Denver and it's just too much for me.
Yes, we're in Denver, Colorado, and we're going to get right to it. We have a special guest house today. Our new friend, Ramiro Gomez, is here.
Hola. Hey, hola, hola, hola.
Bienvenido.
Gracias.
Artist extraordinaire. He is part of the Mi Tierra Contemporary Artist Explore Place at the Denver Art Museum. What are we eating, guys?
You go ahead. You explain this astronaut Mexican food that we're eating.
We are eating gourmet Taco Bell.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Gourmet tacos. Crunchwrap Supreme.
What do you order?
I got the Crunchwrap Supreme and a soft taco.
Okay.
My favorite when I go there. I also like the Mexican pizza, which you're eating.
Babelito.
Déjenme hacer.
Yeah.
No hacer. Ser. I'm
sorry. So Taco Bell, I know a lot of people listening are going to be like, what the fuck are these guys talking about? But it's one of my favorite fast food places because there's no other flavor profiles like Taco Bell. Like, it's its own fucking genre of food.
Explain.
What else tastes like Taco Bell? Nothing else. Not even, no fast food taco places. You know, a lot of people fight and say Del Taco's better, but that shit is weak compared to Taco Bell.
I totally agree with you. I mean, for me, my mom used to call it more like a foreign food. She equated it with Chinese food, you know, or going out for a fancy meal.
Yes.
La McDonald's, el Taco Bell, el Kentucky. I mean, that's all foreign food to us, and it's definitely like, for me growing up in San Bernardino, California, that's like the big meal out for the week.
Yeah.
Taco Bell?
Yeah, like a fast food restaurant like
and
this.
And a lot of these fast food chains started like around where you lived, right?
Yeah, in San Bernardino, actually. Shout out to Gustavo Arellano, Ask a Mexican. He did a whole site visit and study about the history. And in San Bernardino, we have both McDonald's and Taco Bell, technically Taco Bell, originating.
Yeah.
And I say that because the McDonald's brothers created the McDonald's burger stand in San Bernardino, and somebody got real excited about what they were doing, came down, bought the franchise, and created what the McDonald's franchise is now.
A fucking monster. It's crazy.
Con uñas y todo, just
con pezuñas. My relationship with fast food is kind of similar, but we lived in Juarez, so the only time we got to go to El Paso either to visit family or shopping or whatever was on Sundays. Because my dad used to cross the border every single day. So he didn't even want to go back, but it was like our treat. So that's when we get to eat McDonald's. That was our like eating out. Or Taco Bell. But when I was a kid, I thought that tacos, I didn't know that was cheese because I only knew white cheese. So I thought it was carrots. And I was like, that's gross. I am not going to eat these tacos. So I have this weird relationship with Taco Bell.
So. Taco Bell was like a treat for us for sure. I remember my grandma would take us to McDonald's to get chicken nuggets every other Sunday. We would walk to McDonald's. So chicken nuggets. Shout out to McDonald's and their chicken nuggets because
you had them in your calendar.
There is no other chicken nuggets like that. And but then Taco Bell, that was super special because it was just such a weird food, but we were obsessed. And I think it's like the combination of like the flavors, and then Taco Bell masters this thing with temperature, right? So it's like the sour cream with those tomatoes, and then that fake ass cheese with the texture
that looks like fucking carrots.
Oh, and then they're always inventing new stuff.
Always.
Like, so like when we were kids, you remember like they all had all these campaigns. You remember the one with Shaq? And it was just such an amazing place to go to, and I just have all these memories of going and the first time I felt like a grown up was when I ordered a burrito supreme at Taco Bell and I finished the whole thing and I was like, I've made it.
Yeah. Although for me, it was funny because I would finish the Mexican pizza mm-hmm. and like five soft tacos and my mom was always like, yeah. Ya estaba? Ya estuviste? And I'm like, maybe a little bit more satisfecho. Like, no, maybe I just would eat. I would love the soft tacos, especially there. And I don't know. There's just something about Taco Bell that is a weird, twisted home feeling. I think it all is intertwined with, like, the family aspect for sure. Like, our connection to, super, like, these super mega corporations and giant, you know, fast food restaurants is more from that home aspect. Like, remembering my mom driving through pick up some Taco Bell for us when she was tired from work and like just didn't want to come in and cook. And again, for her it was easier, but it was a treat for sure. Like, it wasn't a given thing because it got expensive. as a cheap meal, yeah, it works.
It got expensive, yeah,
but it gets expensive for families and stuff, you know.
Yeah, no, we, like, even my little sister, we just don't do fast food. I mean, we do it now. I think we've come accustomed to it, but I remember my little sister, my mom would be like, oh, I'll just compro McDonald's. And she'll be like, que no me puedes hacer unos frijoles? Like, she will get mad. Because that's how we were raised. Like, food every single day at home.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Frijoles a la olla, ready to go. My mom would always say the same thing.
In the fridge. Yes.
Everything is like, en la casa, ¿por qué quieres tus hamburguesas when I have everything here? And again, it was more just when my mom really didn't want to do that kind of thinking. Where we were driving out, she would pick us up from my grandmother's house. And then McDonald's and Taco Bell were the first things. And for us, we would just be like, yay.
Yeah, totally. And like recently I went to this restaurant and had like a homemade hamburguesa, like Mexicana, you know, like, mm-hmm. like they.
Con todo y el molcajete.
Exactly. Yes, they throw everything in there. And I took a bite and casi me puse a chillar. I was like, oh my God, it reminds me of my mom's hamburgers. And I remember when I was a kid, I was such an asshole. And I was like, Mom, I don't want these hamburgers. You know, like, you want McDonald's, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you want Burger King or whatever.
Yeah.
And you don't
appreciate.
You want
the packaging.
Yeah, you don't appreciate what you have. And I'm like, damn, what I would do now to, like, have the food my mom used to cook when I was a kid every day.
Oh, totally.
Like, the caldo de res, like, all this shit she used. Oh, my God.
The Mexican burgers with, they always season the meat with juguito Maggi.
Always exploring.
Chiles toreados.
They cut the onions and put it in the meat.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Yeah, we had our burger stand. See, and in Mexico, it was like, we had our days. Like, Fridays is for flauta. No, Friday is for tacos de buche. Sunday night was for flautas. Thursday was for hamburguesas, like, in the corner. Like, we were always eating street food, but fast food was a whole
was
other level.
It was high, yeah.
Fancy. So
it's interesting. I wanted to bring up one more thing with the fast food thing connecting to my parents. When my mom and my dad came from Mexico to San Bernardino area, they came separately. I mean, my mom was younger. She was like 13, and my dad was 18, around the same time, though. But my mom was 13, and she tells me this story of how when she was in Mexico, her older brothers and sisters gave her a ID to memorize so that when they passed Border Patrol, she would remember this ID. Mm-hmm. And the name was something that she could remember, but she also was told to say, my name is, before it. So my name is, and then the name. And she would just remember my name is, and then the name. But the funny part is she never really remembered the name. I still don't even know what the name is. Oh. All she remembered was my name is. And she said they crossed the border. They actually crossed through a, you know, just a checkpoint and a van when it wasn't so heavily militarized and they were able to pass through these fake IDs, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But my mom fell asleep. And so she didn't go through the actual border part. But when they woke up, they were already like in the Los Angeles area. Whoa. And they went to a McDonald's to pick up food because they were hungry.
Uh-huh.
And my mom woke up and they were at the drive-thru for McDonald's. And my mom was woken up because they were asking her, ¿qué quieres?
Yeah.
And my mom was freaking out. She's like, hi, my name is, and all they wanted to do was ask her for her order. So she Yeah, she does tell me these little things about the fast food aspect that I connect to. And it's something that gives me a little bit more layers to the experience, you know, getting the drive-through for Taco Bell.
Correct.
That's in my head, you know, that's all part that I carry with me.
Totally.
Yeah, that's that. Yeah, that's real. Like, I remember hearing a story similar to that. And I met a friend's brother right after they crossed. And she came and introduced me to her, him, right? He goes, oh, hola, mucho gusto. ¿Cómo te llamas? I said, and the kid froze. And he didn't know what to do. He looked at his sister. He's like, ¿Cómo me llamo? ¿Cómo me llamo? And she's like, you can relax now. Like, you can tell your real name. He's like, okay. And then he went and played. In, yeah. But you forget about some of these things because, you know, it's tough. But so, yeah, I don't love Taco Bell, and I understand the infatuation.
You don't? Did you just say?
Yes, I said I don't.
Some people...
We were at dinner the other night. Let me tell everybody.
Some people are right, and some people are wrong. That's fine.
We were at dinner the other night, and you guys spent like 45 minutes talking about Taco Bell. I will get out of the conversation and talk about something and come back, and it's like, damn.
See, I knew,
they are still talking about Taco
Ramiro
Bell.
I knew was my dog.
On it.
When,
with me too,
when we were defending Taco Bell together.
Taco Bell sister. Dios mío. But it was very entertaining to watch you two getting so excited about Taco Bell, about art, about so many different things.
I think we share a lot of the things that I first time meeting you the other night at dinner.
Yeah.
But I think we share a lot of these similar situations growing up here. I'm from San Bernardino and you're
Las
from
Vegas.
Las Vegas,
yeah.
Right?
And yeah, I mean, that's why I really love your work. And people always, it's so funny. I was telling you, like, people are always sending me your work. Like, have you seen this guy's work? He's talking about what you're talking about. And I was like, yes, I love this guy's work. I know. So it's so cool that we're in this show together so we can finally meet. But yeah, like you're saying, your mom is a custodian. Like, my parents have always been custodians. And, you know, a lot of my work now is about like Latino visibility, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just cool to have like artists talking about the same topics. I guess we should just jump into it and talk about the show that we're in at the Denver Art Museum.
Why don't you tell us a little bit what you're working in the for this show?
So it's interesting.
Let's start first with what you do. Like, what is your medium? What do you work on?
Totally.
Yeah.
I am an artist based in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and I work specifically around domestic labor there. I worked for as a live-in nanny for a family in the Hollywood Hills. Necessity. I took the job because there was nothing else at the time. Mm-hmm. This is like 2009. And my experience there with this family, feeling alienated but at the same time welcome, and then surrounded by other people that reminded me of my parents, you know, and my family members, housekeepers, gardeners, all doing the same kind of manual labor job, that really became something that I wanted to share with people. And so I found ways while I was working of secretly making paintings on magazines where I inserted figures like housekeepers into luxury magazines like Lux and Architectural Digest.
I've seen those pieces. They're amazing.
Yeah. And those I did those during my break time. I would hide in my room that I lived in and I would paint onto the magazines what I didn't see reflected.
I see.
And then I would hide them and then share them online. So like social media, and it was like a secret at first. Like, I had a Twitter handle that was called the Manny Diaries, and I didn't expose my real name and that kind of thing. But little by little, I started getting encouraged to share it with people, and that's where I started. Now, that went from the magazines in a private way to larger cardboard cutout representations, and mm-hmm. that project came right after I left the nanny job. And was able to go right into those spaces that I was working in Beverly Hills, all those really nice, you know, locations, neighborhoods, and painted life-size versions of those housekeepers and gardeners and inserted them guerrilla style in front of those very mansions.
And take the picture and then post it online.
I love those interruptions.
Yeah, the interruptions are amazing.
Totally interruptions of that space.
The one you did of Las Meninas with that's probably my favorite one.
It's an art history.
Yeah.
Yeah, geek. I love that piece.
It's about it like reinterpreting and recontextualizing, and especially with Las Meninas where the focus is on everything but those nannies that Velázquez painted.
Yeah, I wanted to tell you, there is an essay that this art grad student wrote about Las Meninas, because every time you see that, that is a painting from the early 1600s by Velázquez, probably the most famous Spanish artist besides Picasso. But there is this awesome essay that this guy wrote about all how the Americas are inserted in the actual painting. So you see the curtains in the background, and without the cochinilla in the Americas, you couldn't have that. The tray that they're using to serve Las Meninas is made out of silver from Potosí, from Bolivia. The little jicaras come from Guadalajara. So he develops this whole entire post-colonial argument about how the empire, it's not the empire without quote-unquote the peripheries. And it's fascinating. I don't know if you read it, but I'll give it to you. So when I saw that piece, it made me right away think about that argument of looking at the other side of the of how economy work in the empire, right? So
Totally, because as Velázquez was doing, he was hired to paint the, you know, the king and queen, paint the royal family, yet he chose to insert the behind the scenes of the court. And correct. I found so many connections to that when I remember my experience in the home, being, you know, tasked to maintain and raise these children. They were little twins, you know, 6 month old till 2.5 years old, when I was full time with them. And that's the stuff that I remember going, oh my God, an artist focused on it, but the public doesn't really focus on it, you know, and I needed to reinterpret it. That's why I did that cardboard version.
Yeah, I mean, we will put a link to the piece or a picture of the piece in social media if you allow us to,
of course, yeah,
to share it. But also what I like about it is that that's part of the intention of the original painting. Like, you see the painting and you're supposed to see yourself reflected as a king and the queen. So it's almost like this back and forth gaze of being inside as part of that life, but you're outside because you'll never be part of that life. Mm-hmm. And then have those cutouts. I really enjoy it. Anyway, I'm done geeking out.
No, I love it.
This is
okay.
Keep going. Yeah,
I love
this. This is the stuff that I love.
I'll just keep thinking, because I saw that and my brain started thinking about that, that essay. And I like that play, that relationship that people could have with art, especially. I mean, I don't know. Anyway, tell us a little bit more what you're doing in the museum, because I think it continues in what we're talking about.
It is continuing, actually, just because that Las Meninas piece came at a time when, you know, I was still more in the domestic sense. I was still babysitting. I was still working in those environments. But as I've developed and I've gotten recognition for my work, I've been invited now into spaces like the museum here in Denver to participate in shows, and I'm tapping right back into it. I like to say that the casts are different, but the roles are the same. Mm-hmm. And so here in Denver, the museum itself is maintained by a staff of people. And I said to the curators when I was invited to participate in the show Mi Tierra that my goal as an artist coming into the Denver Art Museum wasn't to do what I'm doing in LA and reproduce it here. It was to come to Denver, watch, listen, observe, and reflect what I see here, because I want my work to always transmit to a viewer what's happening in those very spaces. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened at the Denver Art Museum. I came in, I told them what my issues and my things were. The labor was my interest. And as a janitor, you know, my mom maintains a school, and that was the first thing I said to them. I would love to see the janitors that maintain this museum. Mm-hmm. They introduced me to one, and actually she was just happened to be the person that was there, this woman named Lupita.
Shout and out to Lupita.
Lupita is...
Happy birthday!
Turning 21 today, you guys. Yeah, so I'm about to have mole with her tonight.
Nice.
Which is amazing.
She's going to go out with us.
She's got to go out with us. But Lupita, when I met her back in September, she was only 20 at that time.
Yeah.
Didn't know that. But I also didn't know much about her story. I just was introduced to her, like I said. And I immediately followed her around. She okayed. She was, you know, told about what I was doing. And there was a lot of museum staff around at that time. So she was definitely awkward a little bit. And I was way beyond awkward, because it was the first time that I was exploring and connecting to her, too.
Yeah.
And I didn't want her to get the wrong impression. But the funny thing, as soon as the museum staff left, her and I went to the janitor's closet. And she looked at me and she goes, I thought you were a new hire. Yes! Like, that's awesome. And I looked at her, I was like, treat me like the new hire. Yeah. Like, my mom is a janitor. I can walk around and deal with this. Like, I know what your runs and your run sheets are probably like. Mm-hmm. So give me something to do. I'll walk with you. And she was excited about that. That immediately bonded us, I think, is just... I wasn't treating it as an art project, and right. I don't ever do that. I don't look at my work as an art project. I look at it more as like, well, this is life, and I want to reflect it. And mm-hmm. this happens to be the subject matter of what I'm doing.
Of the piece of the exhibition?
Of the exhibition, yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting. That's so exciting. Have you talked about what you are working on the museum?
A little here and there.
Might as well. Okay. We're talking about the show.
Yeah, let's do it.
So my installation is called Frida Landia, and it's just based on the idea of the perception of Mexico, mm-hmm. and like this idea, this like nostalgic feeling I think a lot of Latinos get when they think of Mexico, right? Mm-hmm. So I had been studying the paintings of José María Velasco a lot, thanks to Babelito over here.
One of my favorites.
And I took his art history class a couple, I don't know, like a year ago or something. Mm-hmm. And I really fell in love with those paintings because they're like late 19th century, and they were painted to kind of attract the Europeans to Mexico to show the natural beauty
Correct.
Of Mexico. And then at the same time, we were doing this podcast, and we did the Frida Fantasy episode where we talked about people love to project themselves onto Frida, especially Latinos and feminists, and just like there's so many different levels to Frida, but she's such an icon that whenever you think of Mexico or Mexican art, she's one of the first people you think of. I mean, she's on the money, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I wanted to combine those two things in one installation using the medium that I use most, which is papel, like piñata style. Mm-hmm. I'm lining the walls of the gallery that I'm in with a collage of José María Velasco paintings as a mural, and then recreating the set from the movie Frida, from the 2002 film with Salma Hayek. I'm recreating the courtyard from the Casa Azul with piñata. So it's those layers, and then
so kind of to like to address like the Hollywood aspect of Frida, also,
yeah, like
right?
the Hollywood version of it. Because when I watched the Frida movie, I was like, "This is so ridiculous." Love it.
¿Cómo se llama? Con el perico en el hombro.
Con el perico en el hombro, Dios. Con el chango en el brazo y con el nopal en la frente.
La fantasía es real.
Hollywood.
I know. Hollywood. So yeah, so the garden from the Frida movie is like so like boiled down to certain symbols, and then the fact that there's like pre-Columbian artifacts in Frida's Casa Azul garden in real life and in the movie. So then I'm also going to take I'm also recreating the artifacts, but not from the movie, from the Denver Art Museum, to bring the Denver Art Museum into the exhibition.
Into the conversation, yeah.
Into the conversation, because most of the objects that are in Frida's garden in the movie Frida look almost exactly like some of the artifacts that are in the Denver Art Museum. So that was kind of my way to kind of tie in. I also snuck in some other artworks from Mexico.
You approached it very similar. I mean, I really was the same way, where I was looking at the museum as my area of like just searching and pilfering and like grabbing mm-hmm. things that are already present there. And mm-hmm. and going back to what my project is with Lupita,
yeah,
the day that I was shadowing her, she showed me around the space as she was working and cleaning, and I just followed. I talked to her. Then occasionally we'd grab a photo, which she was totally cool with and was very excited to participate. And I had first told her I was just going to look at all the staff. But as I was following her, she reminded me so much of my mother mm-hmm. in little things that she would tell me. Like walking into one of the exhibits that they had there where there was a dress. The dress was displayed, and Lupita looks at it and is like, oh, this is so nice. Wish it was like a quinceañera. I didn't have one. And as soon as she said she'd never had her quinceañera, I immediately thought of my mom, who never had her quinceañera either, for many reasons, you know?
Yeah.
that made it real for me. And I just started at that point deciding, you know what? I think Lupita is who I'm going to start focusing on.
Yeah.
I did it. But as I followed her around, taking these photos of her around the space, she walked into the Women in Abstract Expressionism show.
Oh, yeah.
Which was highlighting the role of women in art history, especially in such an American male-dominated abstract expressionism being such a male-dominated movement. I was like, wow, you know, her role in here is interesting. And she was telling me things like the museum didn't allow her to carry a trash bag or any type of carts around that space because she's not, during the museum hours, she's not allowed to sort of gather around these trashes. She's just meant to maintain a little bit, and then all her like carts and all that stuff comes in after everybody leaves. And I thought about, her presence is in here, but and it's asked to be here, but then it's forced to be sort of invisible and hidden.
It is invisibility.
It's invisibility. And I was like, wait, okay, this is another thing. As you were saying, your approach with the museum, the artifacts are one thing. For me, it's this living person that is part of the museum that gets sort of erased unless there's a documentation of her. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait, okay, this is something interesting. Didn't tell her too much about that part developing. But then later when she was out front, in front of the big sweep, which is an iconic large-scale sculpture there that has a dustpan and a broom.
Yeah.
And nothing much else, no hands, no nothing.
Hashtag Cloud Oldenburg.
Exactly.
Whatever.
Es el nombre de...
I don't even need to know it.
He's a white artist. Whatever. Oldenburg, they mispronounce our names all the time, wife, so let's mispronounce their names sometimes.
Who nobody remembers her name either. Anyway,
again,
speaking of male dominated,
that's an Oldenburg. Actually, it's not, but okay.
But Oligo, anyway, like,
yeah, but that then you painting, saw, I saw that photo sculpture of her sweeping up in front of the big sweep. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Love it.
It's about putting it in context for people.
It
like,
is amazing.
Art on one end.
I almost thought you set that up because it's so perfect.
Yeah.
It's so perfect.
And I literally was just having a conversation with her about her favorite hobby outside of work is making desserts. She loves to cook choco flan. That's her favorite thing to do. And so I'm like,
happy birthday.
Speaking of, yeah.
Make us a flan.
Choco flan, Lupita. But she was telling me about that. And I was already in that headspace of like, that choco flan sounds so good right now. Yeah. And then I caught myself again and grabbed my phone camera, stepped back and took that photo that became the point of departure. I decided right there and then that I need to do my cardboard cutouts outside with her, of her space and her her presence in those spaces, and then almost memorialize it or honor it and put something right back in there that makes others reflect on her presence there. Mm-hmm. Of course, with the museum being the museum, they asked me to do something more permanent. And I thought about the juxtaposition of permanent versus impermanence in my cardboard work and thought, all right, you know what? Maybe finding a permanent outlet for this figure might be a good thing to highlight that contrast. And so I decided to do bronze, a bronze sculpture of her in those two positions right outside in front of the big sweep. And actually another one of her moment where she's crossing under the Denver Art Museum logo at the entrance with her little trash cart, you know. And I thought those two images in bronze right in front, forcing this museum and the museum goers to see it every day, is the message I want to do outdoors. Again, it was a decision. And outdoors, it's bronze. But indoors, I'm doing cardboard.
Cool.
And that's the thing that we can engage and connect with, I think, with the museum and its position in inviting us as artists, especially Latino artists, you know, POC, and forcing them to understand that our perspectives are necessary here, and we're going to involve them. We're going to put it back into a audience to think about the museum's role in all of this.
Yeah, well, pretty soon everybody's going to be Latino, so
deal with
the
it.
The museum is definitely heading in the right direction with this show.
For sure.
I mean, brown is the new everything.
With that in mind, I wanted to ask you, I guess, the last artsy question so we can move to other topics.
Yeah.
But how do you guys deal with audience? Because these are historically, these are spaces that it's not that they don't welcome us, but as you say, they have erased us in some way, and we tend to stay away from them. As like I know my family, they and for a long time they felt intimidated to go into these white cubes all the time. So with that in mind, I want to ask you, both of you, how do you deal with that practice of talking about invisibility, mexicanidad, exoticismo, and all these different ideas. But when it comes to the audience, many times it's predominantly white. Do you guys think about the audience, or is just a way that... Because you guys have gotten a lot of notoriedad, how do you say?
Notoriety.
Yes. And I wonder how have you thought about that process?
You want to go first?
I could go first. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I don't think about the audience when I'm making the work. I think about myself and my feeling first.
Okay.
And I think about the audience as a random entity that might eventually come together. I also leave it open-ended. You know, my reflection on labor is what my focus is. I just happen to paint brown bodies. And the brown bodies may represent Latinos, but there's also, you know, Filipino women. There's women Correct. From Brazil. There's women from the Middle East. All of them are reflected in the role. And I love the fact that, because I don't focus on just one audience, I can have an impact here, and I could have an impact in Pakistan and Turkey. That's what's happened. People from there see my work there and
Correct.
Contact me. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time with this museum exhibit, my audience is actually Lupita. It's just a very personal thing. Mm-hmm. She was employed by museum when I met her. And as this project has continued, she's no longer employed there.
I see.
And this has turned into like, okay, how do I honor her presence there? And almost, and the bronzes, from my perspective, are almost like my gifts to her daughter in the future coming back. And hopefully if these bronzes get acquired by the museum, or if they get collected, as a lot of art does, these exist for the future longer than what her mom's presence at the museum existed in, you know? And I think about that. I think about these expressions and the audience, and I feel like, especially in this time and place, we as artists are coming from where we're coming from with our voices, with our experiences.
Correct.
And we, I think, just need to think about these very small scale audiences, the personal, and then later on, whoever does reach in and connect, that's the art, you know?
Yeah.
If it reaches into those spaces in Pakistan, like I said, or Europe, and there's a white gaze there, but at the same time, there's a brown gaze saying, oh, wow, you know, my mom's reflected there.
Correct.
As what's happened, too. I'm reaching both at the same time.
That's good. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I think about, too, right? The personal, like, is political also. Like, that is so important to me. So I had an experience maybe like a year ago where I had a residency in Mexico, in Puebla, and I was making my same thing there. And, you know, for a long time, I'm just going to be honest here, for a long time, I was making art about people's perceptions of what a Latino should be and should know, right? I was giving the white people what they wanted. Mm-hmm. Basically, because I was finding success with that. I thought that I was investigating myself, my identity, but in reality, I think I was just kind of exploiting my identity to make artwork. So after I went to Mexico, I had a bit of a breakdown because I was making the same work there, but it was all a bunch of Mexicanos. They're like, who gives a shit? You're making piñatas? Whatever. Go, like, we're all doing it too. Like, it doesn't matter. And then I think I must have been on the phone with you or something, Babelito, and I was like, oh my God, I'm making art for white people. Like,
I saw the process of the breakdown.
Oh, yeah, my God. So, so now I'm very conscious of not doing that, and like you said, keeping it personal is very important to me. Like, my family has always been part of my work. But also now that I have this platform, like, we're at the fucking Denver Art Museum. Like, this place is legit. Like, they had to freeze all my paper before I could take it up there. Because quién sabe qué clase de papel trajiste.
¿Qué te trajiste? Yeah. Las cucarachas.
So that really happened? Wait, that really happened?
No.
Yes, bitch. So,
he told me about that. They told me the same thing. My cardboard was going to get frozen. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything organic, that's just, it's part of, it totally makes sense.
No, it makes sense. I mean, they have billions of dollars worth of work.
Yeah. Yes. So they have to protect it. So they have to put all organic materials into a freezer. I was like, you want me to hop in there for a few days? I'm pretty sure I got some bugs on me. So.
El cutis lo pide.
Where was I? Oh, but now that we have this platform, right? Like, I'm always keeping my family in mind. Like, my abuelas are a huge, they're a huge influence on me, and I try to involve them as much as I can in a lot of my pieces and process and blah blah blah. But it's also about visibility now. Like now, like this,
especially now,
this piñata gimmick that I have, and that's what it is. There's no sugarcoating it. Like, it's. Now it's like, okay, this piñata style represents Latinos, represents brown people, and I'm gonna make sure that we're visible by making piñata artwork, because as soon as somebody sees that paper, they automatically are like,
these
little kids that walk in, they're like, oh my God, piñata. These little brown kids walked in the other day as part of a school tour, and they got it immediately. Like, their eyes lit up and they're like, whoa, piñata, cool. Like, yes, this is exactly what I want. They go ahead.
And today I saw another group of students. They were teenagers, and they're like, "What kind of material you're using?" Because it was a different audience.
Yeah.
So I see
they
that
they did not
that idea. Yeah.
They did not get it. Yeah. So I had to explain it to them a little bit. So that's kind of how it's shifted, and I'm still dealing with that because I went to art school, right? So like. I love Oldenburg, right? Like, he's actually one of my favorite artists.
Yeah.
And like, I like to make copies of his work in cardboard and paper, because that's a statement in itself too. But when I'm doing that, it's like, why am I doing this? Is it to get a chuckle out of white people, or am I doing it because I really love this piece? You know what I mean? So it's a fine line, and it's this thing that's always in the back of my head. It's exciting because you know, as Latinos, we're always code switching and we're always trying to figure out like, ooh, what am I gonna say? Like, I love these opportunities, but I also wanna make a statement, but I have to eat, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we're always on edge, we're always balancing these things back and forth, but what I found, to sum my babbling up, the being honest with yourself and doing what you want to do is the best, right?
The vulnerability, true. Like, radical vulnerability, and especially in these times, like, being okay to cry. I mean, as an artist, I have my moments privately away from everything that I'm feeling, and it's a lot of weight to carry all at the same time.
Yeah.
And I don't allow it to crush me. I actually do a lot of self-care things like music and movies and things like that, so that I can feel at one with my emotions. I go and visit my mom when I'm feeling sad, or if I'm not around her, I just call her. All of that goes into the art practice, and it's actually connected to and not connected to art environments. I dropped out of school, and my dropping out is what caused me to then find a random turbulent period where a nanny job came about, and it was not something I questioned when it came there. The idea of dropping out of school was a failure at that point. Mm-hmm. And my mom, especially when she found out I was taking a nanny job in that period, she's like, Mijo, yo vine a este país para trabajar para que no estuvieras trabajando en los trabajos que estoy haciendo yo. And she gave me that talk, and I remember being there at that point going, yeah, mom, but I need this. I need something of stability, and I want to create, and I want to do things. And art school just didn't fit. I didn't fit there. I've never really felt anywhere that I fully fitted. And that's a whole nother story. But at the same time, I said, I feel like an artist that wants to explore things. And I feel like some things that even as her eldest son, the gay eldest son that completely forced them to understand what parenting is. And my mom shared that with me too. At that point, she trusted. She kept trusting, and she said, I hate this and I'm not going to accept it, pero you can do what you're going to want. te encomiendo a Dios, and we'll see. And now my mom tells me all the time that she's learned and realized, especially now that she sees my work in museums, you know, artwork that I'm engaging with. David Hockney, for example, mm-hmm. as a same thing as you do, as an artist that I look up to or admire, but at the same time see his experiences in Hollywood and Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Totally different.
Correct.
And it's important for me to take that out of my head for whatever reason it's in there and then put it back out and let it exist in public spaces now. You know, I think that as an artist, Nina Simone said, you know, we have the responsibility to reflect the times. As far as she was concerned, that's our main goal. Anywhere, anytime.
God, especially right now.
And
man.
Especially right now.
Hallelujah.
Yeah,
amen.
This exhibition went from being this awesome thing to this like necessary thing, right? Yeah. So
the timing of this exhibition.
Absolutely. Timing, yeah. What's your mom's name?
María Elena.
María Elena, mis respetos.
Nena,
saludos.
María Elena, yeah.
La nena.
La nena.
So when you talked about dealing with your emotions by watching movies, let's talk about that for sure.
Because you know what, you guys? It was so funny that you guys, in a previous podcast, were talking about Netflix and chilaquiles, right?
Yes.
And you brought up a movie that I've been seeing lately, Viva. I just finished it last night.
This bitch watches it every night to go to bed.
It's my new to-go movie.
Oh, so good.
Oh, my God.
I saw Viva, actually, in L.A. We are lucky with Hollywood movies being able to, especially lower budget or smaller scale releases, get still screened out there at places like the Sundance Theater.
Yes, how we saw Moonlight.
So I went to see it in a larger screen.
Me cago.
I know. It was amazing. Pero the thing is, I watched Viva without knowing anything about it. I just literally was... I had a night where I was with my partner, David. David, I love
you.
Shout out, David. And David was out, you know, sort of from work, and we watched movies. He works in Hollywood. He's an editor and assistant editor in TV. So movies is a regular thing. And we just one night said, let's go to the Sundance. Viva happened to be there. I looked up the trailer, and I was immediately glued. And it was something that from the trailer I realized, you know, there's something here that I'm really wanting to see. Yeah. And I'm so glad I did because, girl, like, there's so many parts in that movie. The music, the connection to an elder was really important, too, because in my time, I've had really beautiful spirits, women, trans, you know, women, people of color, like, people that exist in the outskirts of quote-unquote society, right? But, oh, man, their warmth and embrace in moments where you're lost is so pivotal.
Oh, I've
been... And I felt that part of Viva so hard.
When you watch it again, if you watch it again, notice that the only black drag queen, you throughout the entire movie, you see the entire transformation. In the first scene, you only see her in her underwear. And she's like, pay attention to me, right? Mm-hmm. And the second scene, she has her dress, a little bit of her makeup, but she doesn't have her wig. Mm-hmm. And she says, la belleza cuesta tiempo. And then in the third scene where we see her, she's full on, and then she goes on stage. So you see that whole entire transformation. I was getting my life yesterday. Yes. Oh, yeah, it's my new to go.
It's a music to too film. In there, like those songs and those things, the rhythm of it. Moonlight for sure. I saw Moonlight the other night. Again, I had to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that kind of rhythm and the quietness and that sensitivity is something that you don't need to explain to us. As artists, for sure, but not just as artists, as people, you know, we have sensitivities. And in this day and age with so much loudness, so many things like getting your attention, it's the quietness that I feel like is getting a lot more attention because it helps heal.
Correct.
For sure.
I know that Netflix doesn't have any soap operas, but do you watch any?
Oh, totally.
Maria del Barrio's on there.
No, Televisa is going to get rid of all of them.
Oh, no.
Televisa is going to do like his own Netflix service or something like that. So all the Televisa soap operas, they're either gone or they're almost gone.
Well, I know you guys love...
You love them too,
full
bitch.
Disclaimer, I love the idea of novelas. Like, for real, I never watched them as a kid. I don't know. I just was never interested. Mm. I remember like Esmeralda was a big one. Do you remember that one? I remember watching that one a little bit. But... And then Dos Mujeres Un Camino.
Of course.
Obviously.
Dos Mujeres.
Camino. Ooh, and Eric Estrada was on there. He couldn't even speak Spanish.
¿Cómo se llamaba?
I don't know.
I don't remember.
But anyway, okay. What's your favorite? What do you think? What's your favorite novela? Like something that, a novela that you always keep thinking about and like really shaped you as an artist or... queer POC.
Oh, that's a tough one because there's so many.
I know, but
name one.
Three.
All right.
I don't know.
Agujetas de color de rosa was the first one.
De color de rosa. See, I remember. Okay. Exactly.
That was one of the first novelas I saw where, oh my God, like I remember being obsessed with her her figure skating. Jose Maria de la Torre was also in it.
And Curvas Peligrosas.
Las Curvas Peligrosas were in it. And like the comedy layers to that novela were awesome for me to be at such a young age seeing like really cool. And I think the market for that was like the teenagers, right? I don't know who that was.
Crowd. It was a younger crowd. Luz Clarita. Remember that one?
Luz Clarita.
Yes. We should not sing on this podcast.
Okay,
go ahead.
But that's the thing. I remember laughing and looking at it. But at the same time, my mom and I shared, again, back to the parent and stuff. My mom and I shared a lot of moments with novelas. So when she would get out of work, she was working at the time in a factory working, making artificial Christmas trees and lamparas and cebolla, like all of the factory jobs.
Yeah.
And she would get home late at night, super tired. And her novelas would sometimes be on later at night, too. Mm-hmm. And so she would sit and watch. And after, you know, school with me, too, I would love just curling up with her. And she would watch hers. Like, I remember Parientes Pobres and, like...
Son los parientes pobres.
She would watch those. And she would also watch, like, Marimar.
Talia's
favorite. But, like, I would quietly find attraction to the men in those novelas for sure.
Yes,
so my queerness
ma'am.
Was being identified. Again, Agujetas de Color de Rosa, Jose Maria de la Torre was a crush. So I didn't know what it was a crush at the time. I just was like, I want to hang out with him.
You know? I want him to be my best friend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shout out
Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
Oh my God. And I have to shout out also. I had to shout out my friend Miguel. Miguel Cervantes is a photographer based in Chicago. Amazing. Him and I engage with this all the time. And our favorite is actually Osvaldo Benavides, who's another dude that was a famous novela. Mm-hmm. Younger and has grown up and has matured very well.
Pero le pega a las mujeres, ¿no?
De veras, ni
I
sé.
Think so.
Yo nomás me enfoco en, la belleza.
Ay, pero te gusta.
Let's be real, yeah. Hay días donde uno quiere lo bueno y uno que no ve lo que no se ve no se o lo que se ve no se pregunta,
yeah.
Como dice Juanga.
See, for me, soap operas were the opposite. I was obsessed, we talked about this before, with Salma Hayek. So that was my way of hiding to myself and others that I was growing up queer. So I had fucking
Stop.
Pictures of Salma Hayek
Stop.
All over my room. And my cousin, El Cuate, it was Bibi Gaitán. And that's how I learned. He's like, this bitch is fucking gay. And he has like pictures of Bibi Gaitán. I'm going to choose Salma Hayek. And I had Salma Hayek. I collected shit of Salma Hayek for that reason. But I remember not even liking it. I just remember cutting and like putting
you knew
that.
You're playing a role.
Like I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know because I don't know. Yeah, like the categories. But I knew that it's just, I was like,
I remember,
I don't see what people see. But that's what he's doing. And him and I are kind of similar, so I'm going to do the same thing. And the same thing with family. It was my dad worked in El Paso. He used to cross the border all the time. So when he came home, he would lay down, smoke his cigarette in bed as we were watching telenovelas, and then he fell asleep. And when he started snoring, it's like, okay, a dormir.
Oh, my God. That's so real.
Yeah.
But I would do the same thing. I told my mom that I would have crushes on the women in the novelas.
See?
So, like, different women, I would have quote-unquote crushes.
But you wanted
like,
to be her.
But I... Secretly, like, Sasha. I remember Sasha in, like, El Premio Mayor. And I remember telling my mom, like, I love Sasha, Mom. And it was like, I want to... That's my girlfriend. My mom would always be like... Hi, Seiko. And really, it was like, oh, yeah, probably being read like a book here by my mom, but whatever. I kept it up. It worked for a little bit. But
Do you ever guys watch one of the first TV Azteca soap operas called Mirada de Mujer?
No.
Oh, my God. We need to find it and watch it. It's still, you watch it right now, and it's like a really good show. That was the first time that I saw a soap opera at least talk about a gay character. Mm-hmm. Because in it's about this lady in her 50s who leaves her husband to be with a guy in his 30s or something like that. escándalo. Like, it was like the most escandalosa novela, like, of the late 90s, I think it was. Oh, or, wow. Yes. But she thought that her son was gay. So there was a scene that I saw it once, and it stuck in my head because I was a teenager and I was getting more aware of everything. That she goes to the bookstore and she goes, I need the section of diseases. And the book guy is like, why? He goes, because I want to find out more about being gay. And the guy is like, being gay is not a disease. And then goes and takes her to that section. And that was the only time I saw, at least growing up, something about being gay in telenovelas. I mean, besides the usual, like,
clown dramatic
or whatever. Yeah. Yes.
Or clown. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
What about now? Like, let's fast forward.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because right now, jumping off of the what now, right? Back then, I would watch those novelas, but I also watched the TV Azteca aspect, right? TV Azteca and Televisa were the main things. And my parents sometimes would have cable. Sometimes they wouldn't afford it. So we wouldn't. And I would watch it or TV at my grandmother's house. But anyway, I would find shows back then that were technically my shows, you know? Like, I would watch The Simpsons, for example. I watched for the first time in Spanish dubbing on TV Azteca.
Oh, me too.
I would watch Super Campeones, which was a soccer...
Yes! Oh, Super Campeones! I forgot about them! With Oliver. We used to have our Super Campeones parties with, like, balloons, and it was like this... Oh, my God.
I would watch Super Campeones back then. I would watch, actually, La Niñera, the friend dresser.
Sí. Mr. Chefiel.
Netflix Mexico has The Nanny, all the seasons.
But in Spanish. Yeah. And it was normal to me. I actually didn't even question it. I would watch Televisa sometimes for certain shows, like Odisea Burbujas. I would watch soccer. So I would watch Fútbol de México, Chivas, which is my team for sure. But there was a lot of that. Uh-huh. And I would gather with my mom for novelas, like I said. But then I would watch all these other shows. Then I went through a Daria phase, heavy for MTV. So Daria,
you know,
was
there's
major.
A guy in the museum. His name is Quinn. And I told him, I was like, was she, Quinn, was, like Daria.
Was he president? Was he? Is he part of the fashion club?
You know? He's like, yeah. People used to tell me if I was part of the fashion club. I was like, I'm sorry. I'll stop. I'll reference Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman from now on.
Oh my God! Yeah,
he didn't like that either.
So it's funny, and I bring up Daria only because that's what I've been watching lately now too. I have it on DVD. I watch a lot of Daria. I was always Team Jane. I felt like the painter in there, but I also at points was Quinn, and other points I was Daria, and other points I was like, you know, Sandy. And there's all moments that you just identify within those worlds, right?
Yeah.
So I watched that a lot. I also have been watching a lot of just random movies that I've collected over the years. Like, there's one of my favorites is a Diego Luna film called Mr. Lonely. That's a Harmony Korine director.
Cool.
He plays a Michael Jackson impersonator.
Oh.
And he plays a Michael Jackson impersonator living in Paris, where he stumbles in with a group of other impersonators, Marilyn Monroe and Charlie Chaplin, and they all live in this commune where they're all like living as characters.
Damn.
It's really interesting, quiet as well. Uh-huh. And I love that movie. I watch it over and over. I watch movies like that I've seen before and I go back to. I watch a lot of Mrs. Doubtfire. The nanny thing for me definitely comes from Mrs. Doubtfire.
Oh, shit.
When I was younger, my mom and my dad again had the cable, or sometimes didn't, and we had VHSs. And my dad gave me a VHS copy of Mrs. Doubtfire when I was like 8, 7. And we watched it over and over.
I love that movie.
And my grandmother would love to watch it. Even though she didn't understand it, she would always be like, she would be like, hijo, pon la película del hombre que se viste de mujer. And we just sit there and laugh.
I quote that movie constantly. And I don't think Emmanuel... Yes! Emmanuel, yesterday when we were getting beanies and you put the scarf over your head, I was like, matchmaker, make me
I've seen
match.
The movie many times, but I don't remember.
Find, catch me a catch. It's from Mrs. Doubtfire.
I've seen that movie many times. But
oh
I cannot
God.
Quote it.
Rest in peace, Robin Williams. Because I heard they were gonna come out with a part two before he passed away.
Oh. And it was heavy for me because it's where like the characters and the actors that portray such pivotal points of ours when they pass, especially with all the passings of like important figures.
Yeah.
I've been mourning the Robin Williams death for sure.
Man, that was a shock. That's shocker for real. Because, like, epic movies. Like, Jumanji is one of my favorite movies.
For sure.
And Robin Williams is in that. The movie Jack.
Jack with Jennifer Lopez.
J-Lo is a teacher.
Miss Marquez and Jack. I love that movie. That's a fucking weird movie, too. Like, if you watch it again.
But he was not afraid of those characters. That's what I love about him. He is so pivotal because of characters that weren't not to say normal, they're just, we're a little bit out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know, we just grew up in a time where Hollywood definitely put some stories out that maybe the inclusion of Jennifer Lopez, I added a little of my interest because J-Lo definitely was someone that I didn't see with Robin Williams, but it worked in that movie.
Yeah. That was like one of her first big movie roles.
Aside from Selena, though. I mean,
was it after Selena?
It was first. Selena's her first major
Selena
one.
Oh, first? Oh, okay.
So was she black, white, or brown in that movie?
She was
brownish.
White.
Brownish skin.
She was beige. Beige. No, like the character.
Yeah.
Okay. I just making sure.
Oh, definitely did not go there with character at all. But it's just the story, right? The weirdness of Jack himself and the sadness. One.
Yeah.
There's some sadness to that movie.
And Bill Cosby was in that movie too. Rest in peace to Bill Cosby too. He's dead to me. So, yeah, this has been really, really fun. And let's take a little break.
Yeah.
Let's just finish our Taco Bell and then we'll be back.
Recommendation?
After these messages. Today's episode has been brought to you by Lola's Cocina. That's lolascocina.com. Babelito, can you tell us a little bit about Lola's Cocina?
They have wonderful products. They have things like hibiscus jam that you can put in your favorite toast, salsa negra for, you know, los tacos de camarón, vanilla bean sugar for those special cookies, and quince jam for your favorite quinceañera.
Quince jam?
Yeah, that's
no, bitch, it's quince.
Oh. Anyway,
what is quince?
Quince is membrillo, and it's delicious.
Pero por qué dijiste quince, güey?
Porque because I was reading it right.
Yes. Yeah, lolascocina.com again, and you can go to lolascocina.com/shop for your favorite holiday gifts. And we're back.
Get boom.
What's happening?
You look at me. me echo dos ojos de este cabrón. So, no. Okay, let's do our recommendations for today. Do you want to start?
No, you start.
Okay. Mine is easy because we were talking about the best soap opera ever created. I just looked at it, and it's the 120 capítulos. There are like around 40 to 45 minutes of Mirada de Mujer. They're on YouTube. So Google it, loca. Mirada de Mujer. And it's just, they talk about race. They have the first black character in soap operas that I remember seeing, besides all those jokes like Marimar's mommy horrible figure. Remember that? Oof. Yes. No, but this is, they talk about the Afro-Mexican population and the role he plays. They talk about racism, they talk about homophobia, and this was the first time that Mexicans were exposed to that. So this soap opera changed the game. And there were other soap operas that came after that similar, but it didn't last. Like, we need to keep people dumb, right? So they came back to the casta painting formula that we are familiar with. But anyway, so Mirada Mujer is my recommendation, but I'm very interested, Ramiro. Oh, no, let's go with you first, and then we'll finish with Ramiro. What is...
Fine.
Señor Fabi.
Well, I've been obsessed with Issa Rae's new TV show, Insecure. Yes. I just finished it last night. And
don't say anymore.
Oh yeah, you haven't finished it.
No, I saw the first capítulo and I was screaming. I was like,
she
so good.
Has done did it. Like, it's just so cool to see a person of color, first of all,
and
right?
A YouTube star too,
and
no?
A YouTube star, right? Oh, she started with the Awkward Black Girl series on YouTube, and then a real ass HBO show, and it's funny, and there's
smart,
people
well-written.
Of all colors, shapes, sizes.
Yes.
And it's showing this LA that I don't think has been seen before. And also, it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful show, like Insecure, and it's really funny.
It's just an HBO Go.
It's on HBO, so steal somebody's password, figure out how to watch it, because I recommend. Okay, Ramiro.
Yeah, my recommendation actually is assistance of many organizations that I love and support and really value, especially in days like this that we're living and times like this that we're living. So one is Culture Strike, culturestrike.org. I really support. Shout out to Culture Strike, Favi, Julio Salgado out there.
Julio!
All these really amazing artists that are just existing and working and actively participating in those boundary blurrings and those boundary spaces that don't have art servicing people and community and doing what art needs to do. So culturestrike.org, support them, donate to them. Others like the National Domestic Workers Alliance, the National Day Labor Organizing Network. Mm-hmm. All of those need our funds for sure. Latinos Who Lunch need our funds.
Okay, cash check, right? Money order, EBT, whatever you got, send it our way.
So that the stories can get out there. And it's interesting because, again, coming from where I'm from, San Bernardino, I just have had to find my ways to battle through family members that didn't want me to be an artist, and yet I still became one. Culture Strike is full of those people that are just existing, creating art. And then it goes into the Hollywood aspect. I would not be doing what I'm doing without my experience as a nanny.
Yeah.
But like in Hollywood, you know, and the maintenance and the service of Hollywood, all those TV shows, HBO you mentioned with, you know, those shows that are being promoted there. My partner David has worked for, you know, TV shows like True Blood, where he's a assistant editor maintaining that. And I've seen them go from job to job, and it's not just done. I mean, there's a lot of work and effort, and everything happens to be maintained. You know, those directors, those executives, everyone has domestic labor that they need to make those shows. And I have that awareness. So I'm thinking about what my role is as an artist. I think of what it is that we're doing here. And I feel that, you know, just like what Julio Salgado is doing with amazing little shows like Osito and, you know, Undocumented and Awkward, and these little TV shows that can grow into an HBO show in the future.
Totally.
Latinos Who Lunch, you know, becoming something bigger and having community. Those are my recommendations for sure. Let's support those artists. Let's support
those badass
artists that are out there working and striving just like what we're trying to do.
Perfect.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on our podcast.
Muchas gracias. Es un placer, la verdad.
This has been really fun.
Igualmente. I say the same to you too. It's amazing to be here with you guys, participating in this awesome conversation with your entire audience. And then we'll look forward to more conversations for sure.
Yes, you have to come back on the show. We have so much more to talk about.
Oh, God.
And as always, you can find out about Latinos Who Lunch at latinoswholunch.com. You could email us at latinoswholunch@gmail.com. Follow us at Latinos Who Lunch on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Tumblr, all social media platforms. I'm Fabi Fav.
This is Babelito.
Bye.
Ciao.